Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The headlines these days tell part of the story, Premier standing firm while protests grow in Pakistan. Al-Maliki threatens death for Sunni militants in Iraq. Talks on sharing power collapse in Afghanistan. The popularity of Hamas spikes among Palestinians following the 50-day war. Nowhere do the headlines suggest necessarily a role for the U.S., but it's there just the same. Today, we're talking about where that role came from and what it's turned into. Joining us in the studio is political scientist and author Sean Kay. He teaches at Ohio Wesleyan University, where he is also director of the Arneson Institute for Practical Politics, and where he is also chair of the International Studies Program. Sean is an associate of the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at Ohio State University. His new book is entitled America's Search for Security, The Triumph of Idealism and the Return of Realism. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Of course, we want to talk about current events, but first I wanted to get a handle on what you mean by idealism and its triumphs and the return of realism. So idealism is what we've embraced for the last two decades or so.
Well, not only that, I mean, what this book is doing is providing a sort of updated look at a longstanding tension in America's sense of its place and role in the world. So at our very founding, you know, our Declaration of Independence spoke of pretty broad universal ideals. We had major contradiction, you know, women voting, African-Americans, et cetera. But we saw ourselves as a work in progress. We also claimed a sense of triumphalism eventually because we thought our system was very special and that it should spread. And some basic values came with that. So ideas of belief in democracy and that other democracies are less likely to fight each other, a belief in individual liberty and freedom being important to spread in the world, and commerce, you know, free trade, fostering cooperation. And that has stood in tension with, again, right at our founding, we had people like George Washington who warned that we should stay out of foreign entanglements, avoid permanent alliances. And basically, what I've tried to do is update how realism, less as a theory of international relations, but more as a framework for thinking about foreign policy, would look today. And basically, what that involves is being able to look at the world as it is, not as we wish it to be. That we would be able to understand that the balance of power in the world is really important. So that institutions and international law they matter and whatnot, but they matter a lot more when great powers, for example, are focused on them. And that we should be able to prioritize our national interests in the world, that we can't necessarily be all things in all places because we get overstretched, and that we can lead by example at home so that others in the world will want to be with us as opposed to, for example, seeing us trying to impose something on others. And basically, as I track this throughout really major trends in American foreign policy with time, it really shows that what works best is when these two are imbalanced together. So, for example, Ronald Reagan spoke of America as a shining city on a hill that others should want to emulate. And he spoke of big ideals that were important to ending the Cold War, but he was actually very much a pragmatist when it came to foreign policy. He believed in power, but he believed in negotiation. Eisenhower, Nixon, you know, believed in, for example, reaching out to adversaries as opposed to judging them and not talking to them. And George Bush Sr. did, too. But for the last 20 years, as a final main point here, we've been guided by what I describe as a loose consensus between sort of liberal desires to be interventionist and what are now neoconservative, on the Republican side of worldview, visions that America must lead and bring its values to other places in the world, for example, regime change in Iraq. And so I think we see this playing out right now in the very basic assumptions and debates about what's going on with regard to the various crises of the day. And we have to, as a nation, I think, have a serious discussion about how we engage these two together so that we don't overextend ourselves abroad and that we invest in the domestic sources of our power to make us a sustainable major global leader for the duration into the 21st century.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Sean Kay, political scientist. He teaches at Ohio Wesleyan University. His new book is called America's Search for Security, The Triumph of Idealism and the Return of Realism. So, all right, so realism versus idealism. Realism is actually a form of restraint. It's a pulling back.
Well,
why do you use the word realism?
Yeah, it gets mischaracterized sometimes. Now it's being, you know, I mean, part of the problem is because realist sort of priorities haven't been really at the table for the last 20 years, starting in about 1994 with the Clinton administration, and carrying on through the Bush administration, carrying on through the first term, I think, of the Obama administration. But now there's some shift. And so, again, you know, it's not that either one of these should be exclusive of the other. In fact, as I'm suggesting, the two in tandem, for example, like the Marshall Plan after World War II, Franklin Delano Roosevelt signaling, you know, the major four freedoms and ideals that we want to see in the world, but also he had to win World War II. So he made an alliance with Stalin, right? And there's a lot of evidence that restraint and engagement with adversaries has actually produced significant outcomes. Unfortunately, our politics today, having followed this sort of 20-year period, have reached a point where a desire to have priorities in a time of limited resources ends up being labeled by critics as retreat or disengagement or isolationism or appeasement. And those are politically charged terms that don't help inform the actual need to make priorities in the world. One of the priorities is that we want to be consistent with our values. But we also have to think, how do we invest in the things that we think are important that make America great at home, again, so that others in the world will want to emulate us and be with us, as opposed to seeing us as sort of hard charging and overthrowing governments and things like that. And the track record on that is actually really bad. You know, so on the other hand, when the two have worked together, as I said, like the Marshall Plan, for example, where we invest and we actually kind of take a more sophisticated look.
But that was after abject defeat.
For the adversaries. Yeah,
right.
But we were, after World War II, in a very unique position of major global leadership.
Because we weren't torn apart.
Right. But one of the things, for example, we did then was help build the United Nations. And in the United Nations, we locked in this idea of restraint, that we didn't want great powers to be able to just go after things. We wanted others to be restrained too. And so we would lead by example. And so our posture during the Cold War overall was defensive, with containment. Containment is very different than, for example, regime change. But also when we see engagement, I'll give you a concrete example. You know, we were about to go to war in Syria a year ago, and there was a big impulse to go and do that. But the objective was to punish them for their chemical weapons use. But through diplomacy and engagement, we were able to get a better outcome than the military tool would have achieved with regard to Syria. Now, there's a lot of backtracking and saying, oh, we could have, would have, should have on this and that in Syria. But restraint also helps you marshal and harness your power for times when you might really need it, as opposed to depleting it and finding it more difficult to restore it.
How do we figure what our interests are in the Middle East? For a long time, most of us have grown up with the notion of the oil and that we need to have easy access to the oil.
Mm-hmm.
What are our interests? Are those changed as well?
It seems to me that if you listen to what the president said in a speech to the UN about a year ago, too, that we have four major priorities. Access to shipping lanes, which means oil, mm-hmm. is key. Engaging with weapons of mass destruction proliferation. That means dealing creatively with the Iran issue. Avoiding getting pulled in to peripheral conflicts, getting allies to take responsibility for their security as opposed to incentivizing them to free ride on the United States, and trying to use diplomacy with regard to the Arab-Israeli conflict. Now, that's not retreat, you know, but it also means we're going to narrow our focus and try to avoid, you know, sort of rushing into things haphazardly that can risk causing more problems down the road. That's the tension, though, because critics would say that if we don't lead, if we don't engage, the relative cost down the road of repairing damage can be too high. So an ounce of prevention is, you know, a pound of cure in mm-hmm. that sense. And that's a legitimate argument. My point is, this is the dialogue and debate that the American public really needs to be having. But the problem is, if we prioritize based on the balance of power in the world, I don't think there's any question that Asia is the future. In fact, it's current. And so the trick is, how do we realign our posture to focus on Asia as a first priority, deal with the challenges we confront around the Persian Gulf in an effective way, and especially in Europe, you know, sustain our engagement there, focus on trade, focus on collective defense of allies, but also a new leadership that gets allies out in front so that the allies are the ones taking responsibility, not that America should be in every place all the time, exercising this kind of unknown quantity of leadership.
Are you convinced, though, at this point in the process of doing that, that the allies have or will step up?
Well, this is not the kind of change that happens overnight.
Right.
You know, this is structural. It's deeply embedded in the international system now, because for 20 years now, we've had this basic assumption that America must lead, we must act, we must do something. And the American public, if you look at polling, is critical of the Obama administration now, but they're not critical on the content of the idea that we should act with restraint. That doesn't mean retreat and stay out of the world by any means. But these are things that are going to take some time. I think a decade or so of change. I mean, it took us a long time to get into this structural position we're now in the world, and it's going to take time to change. And so, for example, if the president really wants to pivot to Asia, he's got to make that clear to the country. He's got to make it clear to Congress. He's got to build coalitions for that. He's got to realign bureaucracies and budgets. And in Washington, those are very tricky things to do, because once put in place, it's very hard to reform and change priorities.
When President Clinton started to turn this ship in the direction of idealism, mm-hmm. did he have to turn around a bunch of institutions? Was it easier to make those shifts?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Because from about 1987 to 1994, we were basically guided by this kind of balance of building a new world order after Cold War. Ronald Reagan was negotiating eliminating nuclear weapons in Europe, working very closely with the Russians. There was pressure in the first Bush administration to begin a new kind of concept of spreading America's role in the world derived from its ideals and principles.
That was new world order?
Well, this came out of the Pentagon in a 1992 study. Okay. It was sort of the basis of neoconservative thinking. It was rejected by the Bush White House at the time, the first Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And it was rejected for about the first 2 years of the Clinton administration, which stayed out of the Bosnia conflict, for example, for a long time. But in 1994, we began a new kind of look, which equated the spread of democracy with our national security. And by George Bush Jr.'s, George W. Bush administration, he was saying that it was America's national security priority, a mission to end tyranny in the world. And that's a pretty great objective. But how do you do it? Right. I mean, how do you go about doing it? And everyone can agree it's a great objective. But on the other hand, we have to pick the right tools and priorities that are effective. And the track record so far isn't great in that regard.
My guest is Sean Kay. His new book is called America's Search for Security, The Triumph of Idealism and the Return of Realism. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check us out on Facebook and post your question or comment there. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. My guest this hour is Sean Kay. He's a political scientist. He teaches at Ohio Wesleyan University. His new book is called America's Search for Security, The Triumph of Idealism and the Return of Realism. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. I wanted to go back to your comment about equating the spread of democracy with our national security. That's something that we've gotten very comfortable, or at least our leadership has gotten very comfortable with over the last 20 years or so. How do you actually go about doing this? Let's just go back to Iraq. That was the weapons of mass destruction that never materialized, notwithstanding. What in the world were they thinking when they went over there? Who did any homework on how to turn Iraq into suddenly a democracy?
Well,
and
I mean,
do they?
Well, when we did that in Western Europe after the Cold War, it cost a lot of money, or after World War II, excuse me. And interestingly enough, you know, this idea, for example, that we don't talk to enemies or adversaries and instead judge them and say we're not going to negotiate based on common interests, it was really criticized by early what would become the neoconservatives. For example, the Helsinki Accords in 1975, which I talk about in the book, solidified borders in Europe, kept it divided. But it also built in, ironically drafted by Henry Kissinger and others, but it built in principles of freedom and human rights and freedom of movement and things like that. And with time, that got embedded into the thinking of people in Eastern Europe. And they led revolutions that spread democracy that were from the bottom up. We brought democracy, or tried to Iraq from the outside. And that is done through a prism of the history of the region, the questions about borders, their experience with colonialism, conflicts between Shia and Sunni that we just did not calculate for. And so realists, by the way, were generally opposed to invading Iraq. They were generally opposed to the surge in Afghanistan. The problem that realism has, though, is that if we just look at states and we just look at the importance of stability over, say, democracy and whatnot, we can ignore trends that are happening within countries, like Egypt is a good example of that. So, you know, we backed stability in Egypt over democracy. And when the people took to the streets, we weren't seeing the situation as it actually was. We were holding on for too long. We did something very similar in Iran in the late 1970s. So, again, it's not that either side should be dominant. It's that both should be at the table when decisions are made. And then the American public needs to be engaged about the relative costs and benefits of the kinds of actions. So it's not that we're ignoring the idea that Iraqis should have democracy. But once you go that route, why isn't that true of Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates or, you know, whomever? Another good example is a very noble and principled cause of spreading democracy and values and freedom in Eastern Europe. But realists from the 1990s on were saying, if you do that too far, up against the backyard of a nuclear-armed Russia, that can end up being very, very risky. And so now we're seeing that debate
with
again
Ukraine.
Play out right now with regard to Ukraine.
And trying to get Ukraine into NATO, and that's what is at the is at the
right. And the and the key issue there is that, you know, what's happening in eastern Ukraine is Putin's fault. But there, it's not that things that we have done on the outside haven't also helped feed into his narrative and helped him consolidate his position within Russia. And the dilemma is if we failed, if we tend to want to think that others should perceive their interests as we think they should, as opposed to understanding that, you know, shock, Russians actually define their national interests as they choose to define their national interests. And so it's foolhardy on our end if we fail to calculate how others are perceiving things in shaping our own foreign policy priorities.
Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Don.
Hello. I'd like to disagree with your basic premise that America works and has democracy and diplomacy with other countries and tries to whatever you want to call it.
Okay. I thought you wanted to talk about Eisenhower.
Right. Specifically Eisenhower. You want to talk about how Eisenhower was open and democratic and talking to people and stuff. Well, you forget about his little buddy, Andy Dulles, brother of John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State. He was in the CIA. He was a pretty busy young man.
Yes.
Mossadegh was destroyed by Eisenhower.
Yes.
Juan Perón was destroyed by Eisenhower. These are two democratically related, elected leaders.
Yeah.
And they were supposed to be communists, so they were destroyed by Eisenhower, who did not use diplomacy, did not use working together, did not use anything but the most lies he could stack on them and destroy the countries that those people governed.
Yeah, I actually wouldn't argue with the specific points. The difference on Eisenhower is that he preferred intelligence operations to military operations. And you know, so we can argue whether that was a good idea or not. In fact, the track record on Guatemala, on Iran, is really quite bad in that regard. But that was also because we had in 1950 embraced an idea that there are these existential potential threats to our freedom. There was this document called NSC 68, which you know sort of took the Cold War and made it existential, so that that way there are threats everywhere as opposed to geographically prioritized threats that we might look at. Eisenhower, in spite of what you're talking about, did a few other things I think reasonably correct. He focused mainly on the utility of nuclear deterrence as opposed to the use of nuclear weapons. He challenged allies, like in the Suez Crisis, that were acting in ways that were not commensurate to our national interests. And he stayed out of Vietnam, although he was the guy also who articulated the domino theory first, but he did not get pulled into Vietnam. That began under the Kennedy administration.
Is that where you're suggesting that you can have, they're not mutually exclusive notions?
Exactly.
You can have a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
And not only, but the big thing I would point to about Eisenhower, and this is the most important lesson, I think, for today, is that for one thing, he said that that we need the best foreign policy has to go through the hearts and minds of the American public before we do it. But he also, after the Sputnik crisis in 1957, he understood that our relative position with regard to the Soviet Union was that we needed to invest in the domestic foundations of American power. So he created things like the National Security Education Act that led to big research universities. He prioritized language study here at home. He focused on building things like NASA, the National Science Foundation, the scientific advisor for the president. So he saw our position in the world in relative terms as having been falling behind because we were failing to invest in the domestic foundations of our power. And, you know, lo and behold, he creates things like eventually it becomes DARPA, which actually end up creating the foundations of the internet, which is one of the most important means of spreading freedom today in the world, you know, if you think about that. So we have to look at these things in the sweep of time, not in the immediate situation that we confront. But immediate challenges like we face today do require that these two competing perspectives be at the table. And that's, again, what I think has been missing over the last couple of decades.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Ohio Wesleyan University political scientist Sean Kay. His new book, it's called America's Search for Security, The Triumph of Idealism and the Return of Realism. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Avery who writes, can you have Dr. Kay talk about the Obama Doctrine and what he thinks Obama's legacy on foreign policy will be?
Well, that's tricky because President Obama ran, or candidate Obama ran for president in 2007-2008, arguing that we needed not just to end the war in Iraq, but change the mindset that got us into war in the first place. And that mindset was these assumptions, you know, that if we just do regime change, that we, you know, that democracy will break out in a place like Iraq. But he appointed as his senior foreign policy team, the entire group was pro-invading Iraq at the time when they had a choice, including Hillary Clinton, who comes out of this legacy of mindset. If you look at her recent statements about America's role in the world, the indispensable nation that must lead all the time, as opposed to prioritizing and making tough choices. At least that goes the narrative. So, and then he surged into Afghanistan, which was actually opposed by a large coalition of realists that they thought this was an inconsistent strategy, that it was inherently not likely to succeed. So I think by his second administration, he's also recognized that we have these major domestic constraints, domestic priorities. We need to rebuild our economy here at home if we're going to be an important country in the world down the road. But the problem is he seems, as I wrote in a piece at Foreign Policy Magazine a couple summers ago now, could Barack Obama be a realist even if he wants to? Because Washington itself is so deeply entrenched with this narrative that we must always lead, we must always engage, as opposed to having a discussion about how we might do that most effectively and achieve long-term outcomes that are consistent with our goals. And so he's announced this pivot to Asia, for example. So he has begun to prioritize. Mm-hmm. Asia is the first of three big important areas. The second is the Persian Gulf. The third is Europe. It doesn't mean we're leaving all those places, but it means we do have to make some hard choices about priorities and put allies out in front. And I actually think in that regard, he's been pretty savvy. We have acted with proper restraint with regard to Russia because of the realities that we're not going to get into a fight up against a nuclear-armed Russia. And so I think they tried to calibrate effectively. How do you signal the ideals that, you know, we cannot accept what Russia has done in Crimea, but balance that with the realities of what is attainable? And so, again, for example, for the cries to do something in this, you know, I mean, I don't see a lot of people stepping up and saying we'll do what we really need to do in Ukraine, which is to prop up their economy as an alternative, you know, like the Marshall Plan kind of scenario. Mm-hmm. And if we don't do that, we're potentially selling Ukraine a false promise as to what's going to happen if they take the risks that they're doing right now, as opposed to saying, OK, we need to find a diplomatic settlement of this. And for, again, a great example of that, this narrative of the Cuban Missile Crisis, that it, you know, it was America linking power with deterrence, saying an attack from Cuba would be considered an attack on the United States by the Soviet Union. But how did we get out of it? We bargained. We negotiated with the adversary. We made a deal. We traded. We removed weapons out of Turkey. We promised never to invade Cuba again. And we're all here to talk about it today because John Kennedy made that deal. And that was a deal derived from realism.
Email from Robert. He writes, in your analysis so far, I haven't heard you mention anything about the lack of experience by our national leaders, glaringly shown by the second President Bush and his advisors, Vice President Cheney, and his Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, who had no military experience. Once again, the military in and of itself wasn't necessarily in favor of invading Iraq.
Well, Donald Rumsfeld did serve in the military, but not in active duty, if I recall right. Mm-hmm. But you know, the team that came in with second George W. Bush was actually initially thought to be very pragmatic. It's one thing that happens during elections. We hear presidents say, we're going to act with restraint. You remember President Bush said, you know, we want to be a great power, but we want to be a humble power, that the military should be used to fight and win wars, not for nation building. Almost every president candidate says that because that's kind of the impulse of the American people. But then, of course, they come to office, they do something very different. And even like on China, we say we should, you know, candidates say we should criticize China and human rights ever since Bill Clinton. But then they come into office and realism dictates that we got to work with China. Right. And so that's the dilemma inherent. And the problem I think that President Obama has had is he hasn't articulated this to the public. He hasn't engaged them on it. So he looks like he's torn. He has today very liberal interventionist advisors, like his ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, and Susan Rice, his national security advisor. He has a realist as Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel. And Chuck Hagel is kind of out of that Eisenhower tradition, you know, of calibrate your power, act with restraint. But and it's good to have. Now we have the two at the table. Mm-hmm. But a good example of this is the war in Libya. It looked really good at the time. Get rid of Gaddafi. He's this terrible guy. But how does that look now? If you're going to go to war, you'd better be prepared to fight to secure the peace afterwards, because otherwise the war itself was probably not worth fighting. And that gets back to the Iraq point. But the first George Bush foreign policy team was very experienced, and they were wise and experienced enough to know, like Colin Powell and at the time Dick Cheney, that we should leave Saddam Hussein in place and not topple him in 1991. Something changed.
What do you think
them.
Changed? Because it was completely, of course, there's 9/11.
9/11, but even before 9/11, there was a movement in the Republican Party that became sort of this neoconservative. There were big dissenters in the first Iraq War, led by, in particular, Paul Wolfowitz, who later on went into government under George Bush, who felt we should have toppled Saddam at the time, as opposed to leaving him in place and keeping stability. And that became a movement in the Republican Party, this neoconservative movement. Likewise, the sort of liberal interventionist movement in the Democratic Party. And sort of lost in that was, you know, the value of containment, for example. And I can give you direct empirical evidence. According to Hans Blix, who was the weapons inspector, widely derided
for the United Nations,
for the UN, widely derided for looking silly and being an egghead or an academic or whatever. According to him, his budget that successfully oversaw the elimination of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction was about $80 million. Now, George Bush did go to the UN. He got a UN resolution to get inspectors back in. You could even argue he was a more effective, assertive multilateralist.
George W. Bush.
In fall of 2002, he got a successful resolution from the UN. Colin Powell doing that work, building a coalition. The problem was then we didn't let it work itself out. We didn't let it play itself out. We invaded instead. And we embraced this idea of regime change as opposed to evolutionary approaches that, you know, need to happen of their own accord as opposed to being imposed from the outside.
What are the institutions in Washington that you talk about that need to be reconnoitered when it comes to these ideas?
You know, probably the biggest one is how much we spend on defense. I mean, this is taboo in Washington. You're not supposed to say this, but relative to the complexity of the challenges we confront today. You know, we can have all the military power in the world, but they may not be the most effective tool to apply, for example, counterterrorism, that it requires a wide range of tools that are needed. Likewise, we hold all the relative power against Russia. I mean, between us and our allies. But that doesn't mean we can necessarily use it in far eastern Ukraine, because at the end of the day, Russia has greater national interests there than we do. That doesn't mean we do nothing, but it means we have to calibrate our response effectively. So, you know, the dilemma is, again, inside of Washington, I think there's a few big things that are focused on that we should focus on is how is Washington itself organized? So what is the role of Congress? Where is Congress on these issues? Where are they on war powers? You know, very basic constitutional issues, which they've ceded more or less since the Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam. We need balance in our democracy. And so it's not that the president shouldn't take the lead on foreign policy, but there have to be balances. Congress has obligations and responsibilities to the American public to have debates on these issues, to discuss them. And then we have to talk about the budgets, right? So, you know, we're still spending today more than at least the next dozen, maybe more countries on defense. And we can reprioritize that, because what we really want to think about is what are the foundations of our power in the world. So I can make a strong case, like Eisenhower did, that the way to really build our power is to invest in our human capital, to invest in our competitiveness with other nations, as opposed necessarily to major military power. That doesn't mean you get down to zero defense spending, but we certainly could recalibrate that to invest in the new kind of foundations of power in the world that are going to make us durable for the 21st century. Either that, or we have to tell the public we have to raise your taxes. We can't continue this idea that we can be this global leader spreading democracy and values and freedom, and it costs nothing. Because that also puts too much pressure on the backs of the military, because we're asking the military to go out and take on missions that are probably better suited actually for civilians and for diplomats and whatnot. And time again, we ask the military to go out and do things that they're not trained for, they're not equipped for, like nation building, for example. And so we have to have a serious discussion about that. If we're going to send our troops into battle, we sure as heck better be prepared to pay for that and support them when they come home as well. And that requires either cutting budgets from somewhere else or raising taxes. And we haven't had that discussion, because that's been part of it. We've had this part of our tension here is that we've had this global idealist vision of what we can do in the world, but we are not spending the money commensurate to what it would actually mean to accomplish.
My guest is Sean Kay. He's director of the Arneson Institute for Practical Politics and Public Affairs at Ohio Wesleyan University. His new book is called America's Search for Security, The Triumph of Idealism and the Return of Realism. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. I'm talking with political scientist Sean Kay. He's written a new book. It's called America's Search for Security, The Triumph of Idealism and the Return of Realism. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We've talked about the Pentagon. We've talked about other institutions. What about the institution of Congress? What role do they play in, I guess, the struggles that are ahead if we do indeed want to turn this one around?
Well, unfortunately, I think the broader role there is just politics have become, you know, so derisive and divisive so that, you know, it's really difficult for a president to articulate a policy that would focus on restraint without then, or even an analyst, without then being sort of accused of being an appeaser, for example, or an isolationist. Those are reasonable things to be concerned about, but that's not what realism is. It's about how we engage effectively in the world aligned with our ideals and visions. But the pushback is you know, very political. And so it almost becomes impossible to have this discussion in Washington because there are these very deeply entrenched institutionalized interests and worldviews. And so the question for President Obama is, you know, how deep does he want to dig in bringing about real change? And that requires personnel, that requires budget priorities, et cetera. But, you know, we're as a nation not going to get really a common sense going forward if we can't have a basic agreement on the things that we're even debating and talking about. You know, it's not appeasement to say we should be cautious with regard to how we think about getting right up in the backyard of a nuclear armed country like Russia. That's realistic. It's not appeasement to suggest that, you know, one option might be, for example, that Ukraine would be a neutral country as opposed to a NATO member. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, Americans, if it were to be a NATO member, would have to be asking themselves, well, would we want to go to war with Russia right now to defend the Ukrainian border? And so we're doing reasonable things, I think, to reassure countries like the Baltic countries and Poland and whatnot. But also it's reasonable that the American taxpayer would expect that the allies themselves would take the lead in that regard, and we would support them in that effort. That's rebalancing priorities, not just, you know, cutting and running, for example. That's a different kind of leadership. But at the end of the day, I don't think we're going to see, quite frankly, I conclude the book by saying I don't think we're going to see real change, oddly enough, until we see campaign finance reform here in the United States, because I don't think that there's a real interest in Washington in seeing major change in priorities and seeing a common discourse go further. And, you know, the media doesn't help it. And these kind of programs, I hope, are very helpful because the callers get to engage and they get to give their points and be heard. And I think we need to listen much more to the American public and their representatives in Congress need to make that their priority.
David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi. I like this topic. I think it's a difficult topic for average voter to understand, but the voters got a problem because they vote on what the candidate says, and then when the candidate gets in there, how is the policy determined? How is the advisors determined? How is everything determined? It sounds like the candidate gets in there, and then things switch around on him. And then I'd like to know what the history is about, say, for example, presidential candidates getting basically the advisors they want, getting the State Department they want, getting the policies they want to go forward.
Mm, that's a great question. Do the voters get what they expect? So, for example, not presidential, but in 2006, the Democrats campaigned very aggressively on ending the war in Iraq, and they won the Congress back. The war went on for five more years. And the funding continued and so on. And, you know, because once they're in power, it's very hard to say, well, we'll use the one thing we have, which is to cut the money when you've got troops out there in the field, which is also understandable. But we actually increased our engagement in Iraq after 2006, not decreased it. Likewise, in Afghanistan after the election. Now, President Obama did say we should focus on Afghanistan, but the conditions had changed by the time he became president. That might have mandated a different approach, but that approach was not at the table. Every single option that the military brought to President Obama included more troops in Afghanistan. So we assumed that that was the solution, as opposed to, for example, a more containment oriented policy. Today we see people just like John McCain and Lindsey Graham just recently said ISIS can't be contained in Iraq. It's not possible. Well, we don't know that. We don't know that unless we try it, for one thing. We don't know it if the institutions of government aren't focused on how we do do that kind of thing in a 21st century environment. And so, you know, it was interesting that people jumped all over the president for saying we don't have a strategy yet on ISIS in Iraq. But what is the option, that we should just go in right away and just do something and hope it works out? I mean, so it seems to, you know, so part of the impulse to sort of jump all over somebody to say, well, we want to develop a strategy and think carefully before we act, you know, that apparently doesn't go down well in Washington. But my guess is outside in the rest of the country, that kind of more cautious approach, given the recent history, is pretty well received, actually. And, you know, people may not like in polls, they might agree with the president or his effectiveness on foreign policy. But poll after poll shows that they do generally prefer a foreign policy guided by restraint. But yeah, on the advisors, I mean, Richard Nixon had Henry Kissinger, you know, and they did some pretty awful things in the world in places like Chile and whatnot. But East Pakistan, et cetera, Vietnam, you know, Cambodia. But they did talk to the Russians. They did talk to the Chinese. They did try to bring stability into a world that needed change. And with time, opening the door to China changed the shift of power in the world. And that was a key thing that began unraveling the Cold War. On the other hand, Jimmy Carter came into office as an idealist. But all these Kissinger people were now there in place. It takes time to change bureaucracies if you're a president. And Jimmy Carter shifted while he was president and became actually much more of a realist after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan and the Iran hostage crisis. Ronald Reagan is given an impression that he was this, you know, leader who pressured people and caused the Cold War to end. He was actually very pragmatic. He tried to negotiate with Iran. He negotiated with the communists in the Soviet Union. He left Lebanon when we got attacked. He cut and run, in effect. He was very pragmatic, and that's actually why he ended up being very successful in peacefully managing the end of the Cold War. But that's not the impression that the politics put on Ronald Reagan today. It's a very different narrative, that it was our toughness, you know, that caused all those successes. And it was the combination a vision of ideals that somebody like Reagan had, but pragmatism in implementing them, that actually succeeded with time. And he had some very wise advisors, people like George Shultz, James Baker, who were effectively realists.
Thanks a lot, David, for that call. Loretta in Cleveland, you're on the air. Hi, Loretta.
Oh, hi. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Wow, this is a great topic. I'm wondering, how much of defense budget is spent protecting oil corporations in the Middle East? And why? Why are we protecting corporations who pay little or no taxes, use tax havens, tax cuts, loopholes? Mm-hmm. We need people to ask the right questions in order to get the right answers.
Okay.
And yeah. I think that we should look at things in a more practical fashion.
Okay.
These oil companies are doing us no favors. Hmm. Please answer why.
Okay, Loretta. Sean Kay?
Well,
they're bringing us oil. I mean,
that's a tricky problem. I mean, one answer to that is that, you know, our way of life and foreign policy is derived from advancing our way of life depends on oil. I personally don't think that's great. You know, I think most people would think that we should have an alternative. And we are creating alternatives, but they come with dilemmas too, like fracking or but we're diversifying our oil supply. Places like Nigeria, Mexico, et cetera, have become more, you know, important with time. But yeah, this is, you know, the broader point is that, you know, once something very structural gets put in place, like our dependence on Persian Gulf oil, it's very hard to then make sure that you stay focused on the thing that you think is most important and not continually get drawn into peripheral conflicts as you're advancing your interests. And that's part of one of the dilemmas, because the more we've expanded, the more the periphery of our power looks unstable, and therefore it looks very threatening. But, you know, there isn't oil in Syria. Syria, Bashar al-Assad is not our client state. I mean, you know, so the idea that we're somehow responsible for him is just not fair. You know, I mean, that's not fair to look at America and say, why aren't you fixing Assad? We didn't put him there, you know. And on the other hand, we have client states that we have propped up, and we maybe should think about the things that we can do to pressure them to be more responsible, more effective with regard to our interests. It's not our job to always, whether it be a corporate issue or whether it be an allied issue. You know, I mean, we've been getting a lot of criticism from Saudi Arabia and Israel for our engagement with Iran on their nuclear weapons program. I mean, really strong criticism. At some point, being a leader in the world also means telling allies that we have interests too, and we backed you for a long time. This is a two-way street, and now we need your cooperation with us. That's going to be really hard to do with regard to the Middle East now, because there's so many conflicting and overlapping interests with regard to ISIS, for example, that building that coalition will be difficult. But one of the tough choices we make is that if we go to war against ISIS, the de facto ally becomes Assad, right? And, you know, so like I said before,
We're back to square one.
Mm-hmm. What do you do with regard to something like that, since our official policy is that he should be gone?
Bryant in Grandview, you wanted to talk about ISIS. Hi, Bryant.
Hello. Yeah, I wanted to get your opinion on the fact I've been listening to a lot of news, and currently over in England, they're debating a policy that if you leave the country to go fight with ISIS or any other terrorist organizations such as ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and some of the others, that you will not be permitted to return to the country, ever be able to return to the country, which, in my opinion, I think is a good idea.
You would lose your passport, I believe, is what they're saying. Yeah.
BBC reported on that this morning,
So are you in favor of the same thing? I think, do you think the U.S. should do the same thing as putting their foot down as far as people that want it, such as that one gentleman from Chicago or somewhere up there that got killed in a recent battle?
Yeah, there's a couple. I mean, that's the kind of debate we should be having. But when somebody takes up arms against America, that's clearly, you know, something that is a very basic violation of citizenship, you know, as an American citizen, you know. So that's pretty obvious as far as I'm concerned. But on the other hand, you know, we have to be prudent, at least, about the processes in which we go about doing that, you know, because right now we have a situation where you can put a drone over somebody and without due process, they can be killed. So I think we have to be careful about that, not only because of the sort of question about whether we're being true to our civil liberties and values and freedoms when we combat terrorism, but also because we have to ask how effective it is, right? I mean, when we drop drones on people in Pakistan, it makes, you know, at one level, it makes sense to me because you could say, well, that's better than putting troops on the ground. It's precision air power. You can be pretty good at it. But it also runs the risk of further alienating populations on the ground and actually generating more terrorists over the long haul. So the question about ISIS, I think, requires some pretty hard thinking. You know, we have to think about who are our regional allies that can take the lead in this and then think about how we can backstop them. And that actually starts with the Iraqi government. But you know, the idea that somehow this ISIS thing is a new problem, I mean, this has been going on since we invaded Iraq, quite frankly, and it's spilled across borders into Syria and so on. So but one of the logics that we had on the war on terrorism throughout the Iraq war is that we fight them over there so that they don't attack us here. But in an era of globalization, when you have a passport and you can get on an airplane, that's just absurd. So those are kind of things that need to be looked at. But we also have to be very careful not to lose the values and freedoms that we also cherish in the process.
How does the war on terrorism change the discussion and the contrast between realism and idealism?
Well, that's a great question. And I think the war on terrorism, you know, realists would generally look at terrorism as a serious problem, But in the relative risk in the world, you know, we start with nuclear war and kind of work our way down, right? Now, weapons of mass destruction in the hands of terrorists, that's a very serious concern. And so that's something that we need policies to align for. And, you know, what we really need in that regard is allies. You know, so if we go out on our own and invade Iraq, for example, and we don't have coalitions, how do we share intelligence? How do we share interests? How do we get others to help us advance our policy? And so, but also in the run-up to the war in Iraq, it became very difficult for people who advocated, for example, containment versus regime change to even make the case. Colin Powell tried. He tried very hard, but he did not succeed. And so we got locked into this narrative of perpetual war, in effect. And we've been on an operational military tempo for this country really since about 1989 with regard to these interventions. And so far, there aren't too many that have proven to be very successful. So we maybe want to think about how we calibrate the tools and have a serious debate about the best means to approach a threat like terrorism, for example, with weapons of mass destruction.
Sean Kay, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sean Kay, he's director of the Arneson Institute for Practical Politics and Public Affairs at Ohio Wesleyan University. His new book's called America's Search for Security, The Triumph of Idealism and the Return of Realism. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.